So let's kick off, make a few points relevant to the economy. And what I'd like to discuss in more depth is the economy, inflation, interest rates, and the coronavirus. So looking at the economy generally, where are we? Well, happy to say that the economy remains in its sweet spot. Both the official data and anecdotal evidence remain highly positive. Various stages of unlocking the economy have resulted in surges in the pace of economic activity over the past couple of months. So, to give you some official figures, GDP in March, and that's actually before many of the restrictions were actually lifted, rose by 2.1% on the month. According to revised semi-official estimates, that was the March outturn. Now, in April, the economy grew by another 2.3%. We've got the May figures due on Friday morning. And actually, our forecast is that we could actually see monthly growth of 2.5%. And if that's the case, that would leave the economy around 1.5% short of its pre-pandemic size in February last year. So we've made considerable progress there. Now, we do think that because of the remaining unwinding of the restrictions are likely to have less of a positive impact, and we're at peak growth for the British economy. But even so, we're of the opinion that the pace of activity will remain buoyant, and that's not least because households, on our estimates, have something around £140 billion of excess savings in banks and building deposit societies, which would not have been there had it not been for the pandemic. And that will be supporting demand as a proportion of that. Don't know how much will be spent. So our GDP forecast, for those of you that like numbers, is 7.9%, but it's entirely possible, as I think I've said before on this webcast, that we could see growth in excess of 8% in the UK this year. Secondly, what we've seen alongside the encouraging economic numbers is a rise in inflation. Now, this was always going to happen through the course of 2021, bearing in mind particularly that 2020 witnessed a number of big disinflationary factors, e.g., a collapse in energy prices, as I'm sure you remember, heavy retail discounting at times, and also temporary reductions to indirect taxation to support various areas of the economy, such as the hospitality sector. But the increase in CPI inflation, which has taken place from last August's low of plus 0.2% to 2.1% in May, has actually exceeded our own forecasts and indeed other forecasters' expectations as well, including the Bank of England. And if you look at the profile for the remainder of the year, it's not impossible at all that we get to 3% at some stage. So the main question is here, does this actually signal a sudden but permanent upturn in inflation pressures? Now, we don't think so. And a couple of reasons for that is, firstly, that the recovery in commodity prices has just been extraordinarily sharp. And even if you see a slowdown in the rate of ascent of those commodity prices, such as oil, what you'll see is a moderation in inflation. Now, an outright decline in commodity costs would actually result in a more rapid fall in the overall rate of consumer price inflation. Secondly, and I think we mentioned this a month or so ago, much of the story of strengthening price pressures is connected with low inventory levels. Effectively, what you've had is a big burst in demand as the economy's got unlocked. In the States, of course, you've had the stimulus checks, which have increased spending power all of a sudden. But that burst in demand can't be met by existing stocks of goods, enabling wholesalers and retailers to raise their margins. But what we should see is, as production rises, the supply-demand imbalance should fall away and inflation should ease back. Now, that applies, we think, as much to the situation in the United States as the UK, where, for example, shortage of second-hand cars and trucks in the States is adding something like, on its own, 0.3% to US CPI inflation. So we think a lot of that is transitory. Indeed, prolonged inflation in developed economies is normally a result of overheating economic growth. When activity is very robust, as we've explained here, we're not at pre-pandemic levels of activity yet. And it's very rare to see inflation taking permanent hold without some sort of material tightening in the labour market. And certainly the situation here, there are a number of moving parts to what's happening in the labour market. Certainly conditions are getting tighter. But if you look at the rate of unemployment, at least the stated rate is 4.7%. And that's around one percentage point higher than at its trough back in 2019. In addition to that, you've got somewhere around 1.5 million people on furlough who are classified as employed. And one of the critical developments domestically over the next few months will be what happens to these people, how many individuals on the CJRS, for example, are absorbed back into their own jobs, do they end up into other jobs, how many become unemployed as the CJRS is actually wound up. How will the Bank of England respond? Well, our reading of June's Monetary Policy Committee meeting was actually there was a slight hawkish tilt in members' assessment of the inflation outlook. But even so, and I know we've covered this in previous sessions, in short, the MPC is likely to wait to see how the labour market reacts, given its pivotal role in determining whether a burst in inflation is temporary or permanent. We don't think it's in a great hurry to tighten policy. Actually, if you listen to the tone of Andrew Bailey's press Mansion House speech last week, that was the message he was putting across. That's his personal view. And indeed, history does show that the Bank of England doesn't react particularly quickly if it regards price shocks to be temporary. So, for example, if you sort of cast your mind back to 2008, 2011, we actually had bursts of inflation above 5% at those points, and we didn't see increases in interest rates. And our expectation still is that the committee will wait until next spring to tighten policy. We still don't know whether the MPC will begin by cutting QE, i.e. selling gilts, or raising rates first. And in 2017, I think it was, it raised rates. Our working assumption is that it will try and pare back its balance sheet first, i.e. pay back some of the QE, and perhaps wait a year before actually lifting the bank rate. But you know, another option we're beginning to consider is that the Bank of England's first move will be a combination of both, i.e. a small hike in rates and some shrinking of the balance sheet. So those are thoughts on interest rates. The last thing I'd like to mention is COVID, and specifically, could the upturn in cases in the UK begin to derail the recovery? Well, yesterday's number of reported cases in the UK was 29,000, or very close to it. And if you look at that on a rolling week basis, it's eased back to 49%. But obviously, this is still extremely high territory. And yesterday, the new Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, admitted that daily cases could actually reach 100,000, especially, I think, given the planned ending of most of the remaining restrictions on the 19th of July. The peak at the end of last year, I think, in daily cases was around 80,000. So we're talking about new territory here. And clearly what is critical and what the government is banking on is that the success of the vaccination programme means that the link between infections and hospitalisations has been weakened, as younger people, you know, at least on average, don't contract COVID as seriously as older people. And actually, our own statistical work suggests that that relationship has indeed shifted for the better since around May. But, you know, of course, this could change if a new strain emerges or if long COVID becomes more of an issue. And it has to be said that the next opening up of the economy, planned, as I said, on the 19th of July, does appear to carry a few risks. So, in summary, our baseline case is that the UK economy has probably gone past peak growth, but 2021 is still set to outperform most expectations. The BOE is probably more aware of stronger price pressures, but believes still that most of them are transitory, echoing the view of the Fed in that respect. And on COVID, there does seem to be a much weaker link between cases and severe contractions. And obviously, we hope that that remains the case. So those are a few of our views regarding the economy. Let's now turn to our market practitioner, John Wynne-Evans, for your insights. John, would you like to share a few thoughts on the equity market?
Certainly. Thank you very much, Phil. And good morning, everybody. And I think, you know, one thing I was thinking when Phil started talking, when you talk about the economy, you know, a lot of the data that comes out on the economy is actually, you know, fairly historic by the time it arrives, certainly the official data. These days, you know, we rely an awful lot more on things, you know, sort of Google tracking data and what's going on apps and restaurant bookings and all that sort of stuff. So it's no doubt about the fact we get more interesting real-time economic data now than we ever used to in the past. So the market could be much more reactive to that than it has been historically. But of course, financial markets, stock markets in particular, are forward-looking beasts. And I think it's fair to say that quite often, you know, people are somewhat flummoxed by the fact that what can be going on in the economy doesn't bear much resemblance to what's going on in financial markets. And especially through last year, you know, when things were pretty bad and we're looking at these very, you know, negative GDP figures, people were often asking, why on earth is the market going up? We may get to a similar situation this year when, you know, GDP growth numbers are whopping year on year, as Phil has been talking about, and yet the market may not necessarily go up in that environment. So it's that sort of looking ahead and discounting factor that the market plays. And I think if we go back, certainly, you know, to the back end of last year, beginning of this year, for those of you who would have heard me speak before and seen the stuff that we write, we were talking about something that we called the BVB trade, the Biden vaccine Brexit trade. So basically taking three kind of big imponderables and uncertainties, which we thought were going to be resolved as we went through the back end of last year and into the beginning of this year. So, you know, would it be Trump or Biden? It was Biden, and the markets were generally happy with that. You don't get all the uncertainties that you had with Trump. And then you've got the potential for a lot of fiscal stimulus coming through, particularly in infrastructure projects. The vaccine trade was all about the reopening, and that really kicked off last November once we got the trial data through and saw how positive that was. And then Brexit was obviously all about, you know, whether or not we would get a deal with Europe at the last minute as we did, or whether things would fall off a cliff. So all of those three things were actually resolved very positively in the end. And actually, you know, cast your mind back almost exactly 6 months. We had, remember, the Georgia state runoff for the last two Senate seats, which both fell to the Democrats, giving them effective control of the Senate as well. It all seems like ancient history now, but at the time it was, you know, all extremely important. So I think if we look back on the first half of the year, the key thing about markets, I think the two quarters of the half so far have been quite contrasting, actually. The first quarter of the year was very much about the reflation trade. It was value stocks, cyclical stocks, or what we'd also call short duration stocks, that were leading the market up. And sort of longer duration growth stocks and technology shares certainly kind of, you know, failed to participate in that run up in the market in the first quarter. So certainly when you look at the overall index levels, they're not entirely representative of what's going on beneath the surface. Think of the old metaphor of the graceful swan, but all the paddling that's going on underneath the surface, as it were. Things have certainly shifted a little bit as we've moved through the second quarter. What we found there is that the market was already beginning to think about, you know, when are the central banks going to start sort of withdrawing liquidity? Maybe we've seen the peak of fiscal stimulus coming through. And then also some uncertainties about the pace of recovery. And I think particularly the proliferation of the Delta variant of the COVID virus has been quite important within all of this, because as it sort of has ripped through various economies one by one, actually particularly started in India, but in the Western economies, it's the UK that has been at the forefront of it, showing the risks to the reopening and perhaps the potential kind of two speed reopening that we can get as well. We're already seeing, you know, our people with double vaccination be able to participate in the economy faster, for example. You know, what's going to happen to international travel, these sorts of things. There's still a huge amount of imponderables, and obviously the difficulty in getting staff. I think that's one of the really interesting things that's happened in the first, 6 months of the year. We're seeing it in the UK, where the reopening trade and a lot of the hospitality industries is being slowed down by the fact that people can't get either front or back of house staff. Apparently, there's a shortage of chefs in the UK at the moment, for example. In the United States, which is really the kind of key market for the world in terms of what will happen with inflation and bond deals, for example, there you've got a lot of people still unable to return to the labour markets because of inability to get childcare sufficiently and enough flexibility around their work. And it may well be that these people don't properly enter the workforce again until maybe September. And what we're seeing there is sort of, wage pressures picking up. And you all have heard stories about various large retail organizations offering sign-on bonuses and higher wages and all sorts of incentives to get staff. So certainly there's still quite a lot of uncertainty about how this is all going to play out. But I think the key thing is that the trend is going to be upwards, obviously, and we're going to continue to have recovery coming through. And it could actually have some quite long legs to it. In fact, people are looking for 6% growth for the global economy this year, around about 4.5% growth in 2022. The expectations for global earnings per share to grow just shy of 40% this year, and then at least another 10% in 2022. And it's very rare that you get a major stock market setback in an environment where you've got that sort of strength of growth happening. I think the other big thing that has happened in the last few weeks, which definitely merits some attention, is the shift in the stance of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and what that has done to markets. So basically, there was a lot of thought prior to that, and a lot of the talk that was coming out of the Fed was that they were going to allow the economy to run hot for a while to maybe allow inflation over a longer period to average it's sort of 2% target. And obviously, as it's been in shortfall for quite some time, that would allow inflation to run, well over 2% for an undefined period. And there were fears beginning to build that the Fed was losing control of the inflation narrative, and that actually that would give us, higher and more persistent inflation in the future. But at the last meeting, the Fed definitely had a little bit of it was a fairly subtle shift in policy, but it had a big reverberation in which they've effectively said, no, we're not going to tolerate that. I think we will look to, to rein in liquidity sooner rather than later, if that's the case. And what that has done is to send bond yields quite substantially lower over the last few weeks. And that's put the pep back into the more sort of, growthy and techy end of the market for the last few weeks as well. So say, when you look at these sort of headline indices, you don't always get the full story of what's going on underneath the surface. I think as we look, forward to events over the next few months, we're still very fully invested in equities. You could say part of the problem is that you can't get a decent return on cash or on bonds at the moment. So to some degree, as investors who are looking for a return and to be able to meet our long-term liabilities in terms of, pensions and everything, that we have to take a bit more risk in portfolios these days. So we're fully cognizant of that risk. I think over the summer, the key thing now will be to see just what the persistence of, this inflationary spike is. I'm feeling it's quite possible that it might be a little bit more persistent than the market is entirely comfortable with, but that it will, definitely, we may well have seen the peaks of inflation already, particularly in the US, where we had a, 5% CPI spike up in the May data, for example. And the market certainly is sort of taking that view that the peak is pretty much already in. But we're kind of expecting to see a little bit more broadening out of the market again as we go through the summer. But it could well be a little bit of a wait and see time as we just wait to see how quickly economies sort of do reopen and how the central banks react to that. But at the moment, there's no feeling that we have to reach for the tin helmets or anything along those particular lines. So hopefully, we can dig a bit more into this in the Q&A later on. But I shall now hand back to Phil.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, John. And certainly on the Fed, I think markets will be paying very close attention to the minutes from the FOMC, which are released this evening for more granularity about the Fed's discussions. Okay, now let's hear for some views on currency markets from Chris Band. Chris.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I guess we probably look back towards the back end of last year to start with. Brexit was obviously still a theme that was quite prominent in our minds. We had seen a bit of a rally, especially in sterling dollar towards the end of the year. But that kind of waned towards the sort of January time. It was kind of priced in at that point. And the Brexit story for us became a bit of a sideshow. It was clearly overshadowed by the pandemic and all things that were going on there. So it became less forefront in our minds. What we did see, we saw a shift towards the vaccine rollout as being the main market driver. We saw quite a lot of sterling strength coming in, especially in the first part of the year. And that was based on the earliness that the UK was pushing out its rollout and how quickly we were doing it. And we saw that quite evident in sterling euro. What we saw sterling euro rise from 110 to 118 rather quickly, actually. But there was kind of two parts of that story. There was the UK story, the vaccine rollout going really well, but there was also the sluggishness of the Eurozone and how they were doing the rollout. Obviously, you remember they had all the issues with the AstraZeneca, their commitments to providing vaccines, and it was just perceived quite slow and quite far behind what the UK was doing. And so that's what was the main driver for sterling euro up to that point. Obviously, that changed a little bit as, you know, Eurozone has caught up quite a bit and we are trading around 116.50-ish area now. And we've seen economies open up. And what we have also seen really is at a time we saw a bit of a shift away from the dollar. So beforehand, we saw quite a lot of money going into the dollar as safe haven and other safe haven currencies. And as these economies started opening up and the vaccine rollout was going well, we saw a shift a little bit out of that dollar. And we saw quite a few people predicting a weaker dollar across the board. We saw sterling dollar rise to 142.48. That was largely on the back of that. But things changed quite quickly. And I think we just mentioned before about the FOMC recently. What we saw is that dot plot change. And that was a key thing for the FX markets. We'd already had some like inflationary worries creeping into the market. And there was talk about like how inflation is going to affect us. But we've been reassured by the Fed to say that it was transitory and we're going to overlook and we're happy to overshoot. So when we saw this dot plot shift, it did catch the market quite a bit by surprise and we saw quite an exaggerated move. We saw sterling dollar go down to around 138 and just a little bit below on the back of it. So it really was a little bit of a surprise. It was what they did to what they were saying was what caught the market out. And so we've seen a bit of a shift really from probably the beginning of the year. We was thinking weaker dollar as we move from the safe haven of currencies to kind of basically a stronger dollar. And when are they going to taper? We saw the dollar index rise from 89.60 to 92.60. And the dollar moved about 3% against things like the sterling and euro. So there really were quite some big moves on the back of it. I think for us, as we mentioned earlier, that the FOMC minutes of tonight, that's going to be a real big event for us. I think we're going to look quite closely at the detail. I think if the signal is there that basically the taper is going to come a bit sooner, I think we might be at risk of hitting some key levels in euro dollar and sterling dollar. I think the support levels around 116 in euro dollar and 135 in sterling dollar, these are quite big levels that could be under attack if we do see that kind of shift in expectations. But I guess it's not only the Fed looking to taper. You've got other central banks who are in the same situation. Following the FOMC last time, the focus basically went on to the Bank of England and what they was going to say. When will they taper? When will rate rises occur for the UK? So there were some worries there that might follow suit. I think what we saw afterwards was the Governor Bailey really kind of downplaying things a little bit. He's basically kind of said that the surge in growth that we've seen on the reopening of the economy is not going to last and we're going to see slower growth in the future. And he's also warned members not to overreact to temporary inflation. So that's another factor that really helped sterling dollar push a little bit lower in the last month or so. These kind of comments that we are on a wait and see in the Bank of England, whereas the Fed, I guess, are bit more active in what they're doing. So I guess going forward, focus for us, inflation, I think is the same for everyone at the moment. We know the path that's been set now. We know that they're going to taper, especially the Fed, the FOMC mentioned, and we're priced in sooner rate hikes. We know they're going to taper at some point, so it's just about timing from now on. At the moment, it feels like the Fed might be the first in what they're doing, from what we've heard, certainly for the major economies. So then we kind of look at what dates are might important. What dates might we get this kind of discussions? So one of the dates historically that we've seen is the Jackson Hole event, and that's been a key one where they've announced policy shifts. So that's going to be at the end of August. So that might tie in quite nicely with the timing that they might want to talk about tapering, a bit deeper. So that could be a key event for us that we're going to watch out for. Obviously, we're going to hang on every word that gets said, and the FOMC minutes tonight are going to be very important for us. Back home in the UK, I guess the end of restrictions have been quite a key thing. The economy's opened up. That's going to be very supportive for the economy. But there's still going to be some bumps in the road. I don't think it's going to be plain sailing. I think this Delta variant is an issue. I think there's going to be a spike in infections, as even the government admit there's going to be. I think there's going to be a worry for people further down the line. I think the other thing we need to be aware of, that the furlough scheme ends in September, and that's going to basically make the employment numbers interesting. I find it hard to believe that we're going to get 100% of the people that are on furlough all returning to work. I just don't see that happening. I think there's going to be some people that don't make it back. So on the other hand, I think we mentioned earlier basically that the vacancies that are in things like farming and retail and jobs are being hard to fill. You know, how do we get people in those roles? Well, will that lead to wage growth? Do we need to pay bigger money to get these people in these jobs? Will we get inflation through wage growth? So I think for the Bank of England and the government as well, I guess, that they've got to balance really this recovery and not doing things too early until the caution about inflation. So I think from both, they're going to remain cautious, and this kind of wait and see attitude is what we're going to have domestically. I think something to bear in mind in when we look at the currency strengths, we have to bear in mind relative to other currencies. So for the pound example, we're talking about actually is, there's some good news stories. We're coming out of the lockdowns, but if we compare that to the US, they're going through the same situation. They are highly vaccinated. They are, coming out of these lockdowns, and we're going to be on a similar path. And I think for us, the timing of who does what when is going to be the main focus. Who blinks first, which one's going to react, and that's going to be the driver. So we might even each other out over time, but the initial reaction and the initial market moves are going to be about who goes first. So I guess the highlights really I want to point out really is that we're going to get some volatility around key data events. I think we need to be watching CPI data, employment data, central bank meetings. They're going to be the high volatility points for the currencies. I think there's a risk that we might get some lulls in between as we are waiting for these data points. So we could get periods of less activity. But I think we need to be aware that there are going to be these spikes in volatility at certain key points. So I think it'd be good if you guys speak to your dealers. They can help for you when these points are coming up. We do have different products we can use to help manage these risks. So we have things like leave orders and dynamic hedging and other products that we can use to help mitigate these kind of high spikes in volatility. So I guess that's kind of it really. We are going to be very much data dependent, focusing on inflation, focusing on central bank speakers, and just extra caution on these increased volatility periods. Thank you.
Chris, thanks very much for that. We're now at the point where we can take some questions and answers. We've got just over 10 minutes, I think, so we'll try and rattle through as many as we can. And one question that's already come through, which I think is probably directed towards me, is that we're talking about the journey of the Fed being closer to unwinding its emergency assistance and eventually tightening. Why is it then that 10-year Treasury bond yields are around 40 basis points lower than at the peak in March? That's a very good question, and I think there's a two-pronged answer, which is partly, number one, that markets are a bit less concerned that inflation is going to be permanent. That's helped. And secondly, that actually the Fed moving towards tightening perhaps a little bit quicker than previously thought is encouraging markets to say, well, okay, we could have slightly higher interest rates in the short term, but that will limit the effect, or actually limit what the Fed has to do over the medium term, as well as pushing down inflation in the medium term. So that's probably contributed very strongly to the fall in Treasury yields. There might be some very technical factors in over the last 24 hours or so. But actually, prior to yesterday, if you looked at short dated bonds, actually yields have been higher than they've been, perhaps not than in March, but certainly higher than a month or two ago. And that's consistent with the let's move a little bit earlier, we'll have to do less later on. A couple more questions coming through. One for John here. Do you see a bubble forming in European stock valuations? Particularly tech valuations. What are your thoughts there?
Okay, thanks for that, Phil. Now, we've been adamant that there is no bubble currently visible in the sort of, you know, in the aggregate markets. I know it's very difficult when you've got markets sitting at all-time highs, particularly in the US, the NASDAQ and the S&P 500. Obviously, that's not something we've got in the UK at the moment. And with the UK sort of tech sector still only being about 1% of the market, this is definitely not a sort of UK phenomenon, as it were. And even in Europe, you know, tech is only sort of 6 or 7% of the market over there. And actually the biggest tech stock in Europe is ASML, which makes the equipment from which you make semiconductors. And therefore, I think it's got probably quite a good future ahead of it at the moment on that basis, because we have a global semiconductor shortage. So in many respects, I think the question really goes to the US with, you know, the FANG stocks and whether or not we are going to be, you know, another sort of tech bust as we saw back in 2000, for example. And I think that, you know, one of the massive differences, well, there are two massive differences between now and then. One is that you've got a big core of companies that are hugely profitable at this point and will continue to be profitable for some time ahead. So we've definitely got a different sort of outlook now from that point of view. And secondly is, as I referred to earlier, it's, you know, where interest rates and bond yields are. It's easy to forget that back in 2000, the US 10-year Treasury yield was 6%, and now it's currently about 1.4, 1.35, 1.4. So that's an enormous difference there in terms of the fact you use to discount all those future earnings that are coming through. Yes, there are speculative pockets in the market, certainly, you know, and as I mentioned, whether it's kind of, you know, cryptos, which is a whole subject in itself, or meme stocks, things like GameStop, you know, the SPACs, for example, these sorts of things, where I guess, you know, there is probably too much liquidity sloshing around. But they're not in even in aggregate, all of those things big enough, I don't think, to cause any systemic risk to markets, as we've potentially seen in the past.
That's a great answer. Thanks very much, John. Next question is for Chris. And Chris, do you see markets shifting out of safe haven currencies, in particular the dollar at the moment?
I think we saw a bit of that at the beginning of the year. So I think we have seen a large part of that already. I think, you know, as the vaccine rollout goes well and the economies open up, we will see that shift. I do think it's going to be offset by the things that the Fed are doing and the FOMC. So I think it's going to be a bit tricky to balance it out. But the places I think we will get to is as there is more confidence in the market and we see this recovery and there's a bit more data shows that we are, you know, on our way out, I think we're going to look at maybe towards high yielding currencies again. I mean, it does seem like we ebb and flow between this kind of thing. You know, as we see it in the Rand at times, you know, that's a popular currency for a high yielder. So, yes, I think we will do. I think we'll see more of it. But I fear it's going to be somewhat offset by what's happening at the Fed and all this taper talk. I think if the taper talk dies down and you just see the recovery and people are reassured that they're not going to be hiking rates so soon, then you might see more of it. But at the moment, I feel like it's being offset at the moment.
Okay. Now, thanks very much for that. Question which, I don't know, perhaps I'll take it, which is Nissan's creation of a battery factory next door to its electric vehicle production line in London. Is this to protect the certificate of origin as the UK. I'm not a car industry expert, but from talking to people in the Northeast, I think my judgment would be that Nissan's market in the UK is actually relatively large compared with the rest of Europe and relative to other major car producers. So it makes sense for them, I think, or this is what I've been told, to base their production in the UK to minimize trade frictions. And I think, you know, what that tells you is that in terms of trade barriers, if you like Brexit specifically, the situation isn't a one-way street, which often you hear in various commentary. One here for John, and perhaps I'll have a quick word as well at the end of it. And it's, John, Western governments, they are perhaps looking at 5% inflation for the next 10 years alongside low interest rates to solve the debt issue. Where would that leave the bond market and equities with respect to, you know, discounted cash flows and current valuations?
Yeah, well, this is the idea of financial repression, isn't it? The thought that the one easy way to get out, well, I say easy, maybe the simplest, to get out of the debt burdens that we're currently carrying is to sort of grow the nominal economy faster than the rate of interest rates. And if that's the case, you know, it's like the old boiling frog analogy, as it were. Your wealth suddenly, you know, disappears a little bit over a long time. Hopefully you don't really notice it that much, but you wake up in 10 years' time and think, blimey, I haven't got as much spending power as I had. And it in many respects, it is, I mean, if you know, my money, it's the highest probability outcome as to how they try to play this, but it does involve a lot of collusion between you know, treasury ministers and governments and central banks to make that happen, and it will, you know, require rates to be repressed over that period. So we're still not sure necessarily that it will happen, but it sort of smells as if things are moving us somewhat in that direction. And certainly, I think, given the debt burdens that we have in the world at the moment in both public and private sectors, there's only so far that rates will be able to go up before, you know, it puts something of a brake on the economy. I think the idea of, you know, 5% inflation is a little bit punchy, to be fair. Certainly, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised to, you know, see an average positive gap between inflation rates and what's available on bonds and cash over that period. And if that is the case, that should mean, you know, that, you know, financial assets don't really come under that sort of pressure, at least the risk assets, in terms of equities, if that's the case. But as I said earlier, it does force investors to take on more risk in portfolios than they might historically have been willing to do. Phil, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, certainly the Fed is going to run inflation above 2% as a deliberate aim because it's got a restated mandate that it's trying to average 2% inflation over the longer term. And what we've had over the previous decade, really, in terms of the inflation measure, the PCE measure, which the Fed looks at, is below 2%, and therefore, to average out, you're going to be running inflation a little bit above that for a while. Again, I think with you, John, I agree 5% is a bit on the high side. One problem is that if investors believe that will be the case, then there's a lot of refinancing to follow all the large deficits we've been seeing, and that refinancing will be expensive for governments in terms of borrowing rates if investors lose confidence. And of course, a certain proportion of government's outstanding liabilities are linked to the price index, and index-linked gilts in the UK, I think, are around 25% of the outstanding debt stock. So I think we'll have higher inflation for a while, but I'm not convinced that that will be a deliberate aim over a long period of time. Okay, in terms of another question, tricky one coming up here. I'll try and give a very quick answer because we're running out of time. How should we be thinking about artificial intelligence and its potential effects on GDP, labour markets and productivity? You know, perhaps that's a great idea for a specialist economic webinar over the remainder of the year. But initial thought here, you know, if AI gets sufficiently advanced, then yes, it will help to solve the labour productivity issue, which has been a problem since the post-financial crisis era. But of course, what you then have is you have potentially exacerbated income differentials, which, as we've seen, not just in the UK and the US, but elsewhere, has been a major political problem. So you can see some solutions and some problems being caused by a big rollout of advanced artificial intelligence. I think one final question, John, we've got time for a quick answer. I'll try and sneak this one in. Do you think that the recent bid for Morrisons shows investors are looking for sectors where there's real value? Do you think it's driven by valuation? And is this the start of a trend?
Well, it's very interesting because we've got this sort of high profile situation now in the UK with a household name being bid for. I think quite often you get companies being bid for that are actually very important to the UK economy, but nobody's ever heard of them. This is probably not so important in many respects to the UK economy, but most people have heard of it. And there's no doubt about the fact that, you know, for a private equity bidder, which we're seeing in this case, or potentially several private equity bidders who are vying to buy Morrisons, this is an interesting asset. Part of the kind of attraction of it is that it is a very financially conservative, or has been a very financially conservative company. It owns pretty much all the freeholds of its stores. So someone, you know, who's willing to come along and buy it and sell off those stores and do sale and leasebacks and get an immediate payback on their investment, for example. And, you know, the question is, in the public markets, this is not always sort of, valued fully, as it were, and it needs catalyst to come along in the form of private equity buyers. And this is what we've seen here. There's a similar, deal being done recently with Asda changing hands as well. All sorts of questions about whether this is for the, the greater good and the social good, or whether it's just financial engineering. But the long and short of it is, private equity is being given more money currently by pension fund mandates. There are, globally, probably some in the region of about $2.5 trillion of dry powder sitting in private equity funds at the moment looking for a home. So we're more likely to see more deals. And certainly in the UK, quite a lot of the deals we've seen in the last 12 months have been private equity driven. I think, though, part of the thing, sort of things, is there kind of one-off revaluation, which can only be done in this way. And I still think for the longer term, the better way to look at investing is looking for companies that can continue to compound growth over a long period of time. And I'm still not entirely sure that that is necessarily the UK supermarket sector.
Okay, thanks very much for a really good answer and a brief answer at that. And that's all we have time for in this session. So thank you very much to everybody for attending. And also, of course, to John Wynne-Evans and Chris Brand for their insights. In terms of the next economics webcast, we plan to return in September. So goodbye, keep safe, enjoy the summer, and see you next time. Bye now.